needs a past handout? Any of you need the schedule or the handouts for the first three sessions? Nope. Very good. The handout tonight is about Neanderthals. And I appreciate it if you didn't read it during the lesson, but read it after you get home. We'll talk about it later on in the course. The story that we're looking at in the beginning of human history, let me introduce this handout with just a couple of comments here. We know of two kinds of human skeletons in the ancient past. Right? One corresponds with modern man, and the other they call Neanderthal or Neanderthal. Sometimes the H is left out. Thank you, Cleo. The name comes from a German valley, the Neander Valley. The Thal is a valley. And so there was a cave in the cliffs above this valley in which the first skeletons of Neanderthal man were found about 140 years ago, something like that, a long time ago. And they knew right away that it was a strange skeleton. It didn't look exactly like modern man. And they called them cavemen, right? In fact, almost all of the ancient skeletons that anybody's ever found are found in caves. And so the idea was that ancient man lived in caves. But we know from the Bible that's not the case. They had cities. And what happened to all of their civilization was that the flood washed it all away, scoured the earth clean. And the only places on earth that were protected from the scouring of the flood was in caves. Okay, so that's where any intact skeletons of ancient man are found. There may be a couple of exceptions, bits and pieces of humans that were buried in the layers of the earth that were laid down in the flood. But by and large, there's two kinds of human skeletons. Modern man, or one they call Cro-Magnon, and Neanderthal. Both of them belong to the genus species Homo sapiens. And one's called Homo sapiens sapiens. Wise man, wise, I guess. And that's us. And the other one is Homo sapiens Neanderthal. And that's the caveman. And we'll talk about that tonight. Because in the story that we're looking at in Revelation, there are two men sent forth on horses, as we'll read that. And one of them's Adam, and the other one is Cain. And so they started two different races of man, and those interacted to produce a very violent world at the time of Noah. So we'll get to that as we go along. But just to give you an idea of what this is all about, and the important thing here about the main article that you see here is one of great interest to me as a geneticist, because last year in June of 2010, they announced that they had sequenced a large part of the Neanderthal genome. They found the DNA in the bone marrow of some bones that they were able to reconstruct the genome and compare it to modern man, and it compares very, very well. And in fact, as this headline tells you in this article, we carry some Neanderthal genes in our modern race. So we'll see how that fits into the Bible story as we get to it tonight. Now tonight we're talking about the story in the sixth chapter of Revelation. We've already seen how that Jesus introduced himself to John and then had John do some writing for him, some letters sent to the seven churches of Asia Minor. And then he began a story in the fourth chapter of Revelation where he's showing him the throne room where God exists, and then the selection before the world began, before humanity began, the selection of the Lamb. God would not, of course, start humanity on its trek through history without having a remedy for sin, because man was made in such a way that he could sin. He could choose not to follow God. And God knew that, and so the Lamb was chosen first, and then God made man. And that's where the story ended last week. And that's where we take it up in tonight's lesson, in the sixth chapter. Now, the chapter is paced by the opening of the seven seals on a scroll. Who had that scroll originally? God had it in his hand originally, and when Jesus volunteered to be the Lamb, he ascended the throne and God handed the scroll to him. He was the only one, and we've talked about this, Ken's talked about it in some sermons, the only one ever who could serve as the Lamb of God to take away the sins of the world. So it was exclusively his role. And that gave him the authority to open the seal, the first seal, and as this book unrolls, it's a scroll, as it unrolls, he hits another seal, that one has to be broken, and then the second seal reveals some more of what God has written on this scroll. And it's interesting because the implication is that God had the history of humanity written out already, and it unfolds as Jesus, at least in this vision that John is seeing, it unfolds as Jesus unrolls the scroll. Now, remember, too, we're seeing a replay. This is like a story that God has prepared for John to see in these visions. And so he's going to see what this all of this history. Now, this is my take on Revelation, and remember, there I need to say this every time. There are other views of how Revelation should be interpreted, but the one that struck me was the historical view that we see here. And as we go through, you'll find that history follows right along with the story that we see in Revelation. I think it is an accurate representation of what God intended. So, as the scroll unrolls, then these different things happen, and John sees these visions that God is replaying his perspective on what all of this history means, because it's not clear to us how God looks at it. Sometimes we have the history in Genesis of this same period from human perspective, but now he's showing his take on it as this happens. And so we see that God deliberately sends Adam forth to conquer. And let's look at those verses in Revelation 6. The first two verses are the first seal. I watched as the Lamb opened the first of the seven seals. Then I heard one of the four living creatures say in a voice like thunder, "Come." I looked, and there before me was a white horse. Its rider held a bow, and he was given a crown, and he rode out as a conqueror bent on conquest. Some people look at that and they think that's Jesus, but we'll see Jesus on a white horse over in the 19th chapter of Revelation, and it's a different story there. The crown that this individual wears is a stephanon. That is a crown that was given to him as a conqueror. And so who's he going to conquer? Well, in Genesis 1:28, we read, God blessed them. Who's them? Adam and Eve. And said to them, be fruitful and increase in number. And that's an important point. They're going to have a lot of children over the years. Fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish of the sea, the birds of the air, and over every living creature that moves on the ground. So what's he going to conquer? He's going to conquer the world, isn't he? He's in charge of all life on the world as it began. And so he has, Adam and Eve have children, and then the second seal is opened. and we'll see what happens. I meant to tell you about this. This is sort of a diagram, a graph, showing the length of life of this first generation and the following generations of Adam's descendants. And as it's depicted in the fifth chapter of Genesis, and they lived a long, long time. You can see the age at which it says, and he died. And as we'll see later on, we don't know that very many of them died a natural death. They may have been killed in the violence of the world that took off about halfway through this story. But he had a son named Seth, and that's where the step goes up. And the next step goes up when Seth had a son, and his name was, I can't read it in my, Enoch. Enosh, okay. And then Canaan, and Mahalalel, and Jared, and then Enoch, and then Methuselah, and then Lamech, and then Noah. And you see, there's a, in the record that we have in Genesis 5, we're given the total age of each of these individuals. We're given the age at which the son was born. And the blacked in area is the period of time in which he may have reigned as a patriarch. And that is, he would have been the oldest in the family. The only one who didn't get to do that, of course, was Enoch, who was taken by God at the relatively young age of 365 years, and also Lamech, who died in the flood, or at the time of the flood. Actually, he died 5 years before the flood. So we have a record of their generations and the times, and it's all internally consistent. No one lived past the time of the flood except Noah and his sons, the top two bars in the story here. And so we have all of this detailed information that is internally consistent and tells us that first world from Adam's, either Adam's creation or Adam leaving the Garden of Eden, down to the time of the flood was about 1,656 years. And so 1,500 years of history here. Now, people that lived as long as these men did and their wives, and of course, if Adam had a son when he was 100 and something years old, his wife was that age too, or perhaps slightly younger. And so they bore children throughout a big part of their total lifespan here. Another thing that I need to emphasize while we're talking about this lineage of people is that Adam and Eve were made from the same set of genetics, right? Eve was made from Adam's tissues, whatever it means when it said he took a rib and formed Eve from that rib, means that she had the same genetics that he did. He had to make a slight change in the X and Y chromosomes to make that function the way it should, but certainly God's capable of doing that. He invented the genome to begin with. So all of the people in this lineage looked alike. They looked as much alike as identical twins. There may be slight differences that are brought about by changes in the environment, perhaps, although it was a very uniform environment. But it would be difficult to identify people if everybody looks alike. Did you ever see a story? I think there have been some stories, legends or maybe novels that center on such a scenario where everybody looks the same and you have trouble distinguishing individuals. How do you do that? How could you handle that? You have to mark them in some way, don't you? One scene in ancient history is that individuals wore tattoos that identified them. And that's a possibility. But everybody had a name, and as these families grew, we'll see later on, there probably were a very rapid exponential growth. It's thought that Adam and Eve, this is something that the Jews tell us from the material passed down through their history is that Adam and Eve had 56 children, 33 boys and 23 girls, I think is something like that. That's a lot of kids over a long period of time. And if every generation did that, then the world is going to fill up with people pretty quick. One other thing to point out about this is that they all lived in a single continent. There was only one continent at the start, and until about 60 years ago, no one believed it, but that the continents are relatively recent. The timing of the formation of the continents is argued extensively among geologists and so on. But in Genesis 10:25, you'll find that in the days of Peleg, the earth divided. That could mean that it divided into continents that we see today, and they gradually drifted apart, forming the Atlantic Ocean. So all of those are background things that we talked about in connection with the flood, and that comes up next week. So we won't go there today. But here's this one lineage of people that are relatively following God honestly, sincerely, and they're called the sons of God. They're named over in the first verse of the sixth chapter of Genesis. And that's another verse that's been misunderstood in the past, that the sons of God married the daughters of men. Well, men is the other race that we're going to look at. So, the second seal. When the Lamb opened the second seal, I heard the second living creature say, "Come." Why are the living creatures involved in the sending forth of these visions? And we don't know which one is first and second and third and fourth, but they're each involved in sending forth the horse, which leads me to believe that might be one reason why they were chosen for this task. Then another horse came out, a fiery red horse. Its rider was given power to take peace from the earth and to make men slay each other. To him was given a large sword. Who gave him the power? You think God gave him the power? I would say Satan gave him the power. And we'll see in Genesis 4, Cain said to his brother Abel, "Let's go to the field." And while they were in the field, Cain attacked his brother Abel and killed him. Now that's the first record of a murder in the Bible. And why did Cain kill Abel? Well, in the New Testament, it tells us a little bit more about that over in, well, in several of the writers, but especially in Hebrews. But God had accepted Abel's sacrifice and not Cain's. Wasn't that the point? And Cain was angry and killed Abel. Cain attacked his brother Abel and killed him. And then the Lord said to Cain, "Where is your brother Abel?" "I don't know," he replied. "Am I my brother's keeper?" The Lord said, "What have you done? Listen, your brother's blood cries out to me from the ground." Do you ever think about that? That someone is murdered, they bleed out on the ground, and the blood cries out to God? How does that happen? What does it mean, actually? God takes note of an event like this, doesn't he? In fact, he notes everything that happens. But your brother's blood cries out to me from the ground. Now you are under a curse and driven from the ground, which opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. When you work the ground, it will no longer yield its crops for you. It sounds almost like the ground is alive, doesn't it? You will be a restless wanderer on the earth. Cain said to the Lord, "My punishment is more than I can bear. Today you're driving me from the land, and I will be hidden from your presence. I'll be a restless wanderer on the earth, and whoever finds me will kill me." But the Lord said to him, "Not so. If anyone kills Cain, he will suffer vengeance seven times over." Over in the 26th chapter of Leviticus, there's an example of the sevenfold vengeance of God. It's a pretty severe punishment. Then the Lord put a mark on Cain so that no one who found him would kill him. So here's the first instance of a murder, and there was to be no vengeance, right? In fact, that seems to be the rule in the first earth, in the antediluvian earth world, that if someone killed someone, no one would be instructed to go and kill in retribution for that murder. In the time of Moses and the children of Israel, there was a program for vengeance, wasn't there? That the relatives of the one who was murdered could kill the murderer if he didn't reach a city of refuge in time. So there's a difference in the two systems. And in fact, at the time of Noah, God specifically declared that if one kills a human being, then his life must be taken in retribution. But God has always said, vengeance is mine. I will repay. And he repays in our world through the governments that he has instituted. All right. They're not going to kill Cain in retribution. And in fact, that may be the rule for that world, that the murderer was not killed in vengeance by the family of the one who died. And in Genesis 4, we have the descendants of Cain. Now here we're given 8 generations of his descendants, and we're not given any information about how old they were, how long they lived. We're just given the sequence. Adam was the father of Cain, was the father of Enoch. He was the father of Irad. That Enoch in the third generation is different from the Enoch in among the sons of God. Irad, Mahujael, Methusael, Lamech, and then we know something about Lamech and his sons in the 7th and 8th generations. And so all we know about that early world is just in a few cryptic remarks in the 4th and 5th chapters of Genesis, but it does give us some clues. Lamech married 2 women, and it may be the institution of marriage was altered at this point among men, certainly not among the sons of God. But he married 2 women, one named Ada and the other Zillah. Ada gave birth to Jabal, and he was the father of those who live in tents and raise livestock. His brother's name was Jubal. He was the father of all who play the harp and flute. Zillah also had a son, Tubal-Cain, who forged all kinds of tools out of bronze and iron. Tubal-Cain's sister was Naamah. We don't know why his sister was named. If she's significant in the story or not, she doesn't appear. Some have proposed that she may have been the wife of Noah, but I think this is much earlier than Noah. I don't see any farmers in that group, do you? They were raising livestock for food, and undoubtedly they were hunting. That's the story about the Neanderthals, is that they were supposed to be great hunters, killing big game, and they lived largely on meat. But in the handout I gave you, there's some evidence that they also ate vegetables. And that leads to an interesting conjecture that we'll talk about in a minute. Lamech said to his wives, Ada and Zillah, listen to me, wives of Lamech, hear my words. I have killed a man for wounding me, a young man for injuring me. If Cain is avenged 7 times, then Lamech 77 times. Nice guy. He got into some sort of a fight, and the other person injured him, and he killed him. In vengeance, but not for a death, just for an injury, you see. And Lamech's willing to do that over and over again, I suppose. I don't know that 24th verse exactly what that implies. But he knew about Cain and his vengeance, didn't he? And in fact, he named his son Tubal-Cain. Does anybody know what that word, what that name means? Do you have a footnote anywhere in your Bible about that? I couldn't find the meaning of the name, but if you do, let me know. I'd be interested in knowing. So here's a violent man. And apparently that's typical of the world in which these people lived. The current issue of National Geographic, interestingly, has a story about the other humans. There are two races of humans in the ancient world, the modern human and the Neanderthal. All of the other skeletons that they talk about as being precursors of humans, they're all apes. No argument about it. They think that humans came from apes, the evolutionists do. But that's not the story in the Bible, is it? But there were two sets of humans, and they were both sent out on horses. You see, one was Adam, the other one was Cain, and they both made distinct races of people. And you can see this particular individual was pointed out in National Geographic. There was a fairly long, extensive story about what's known about Neanderthals. And you can see this individual here, the full face. This is a female. Her name is Wilma. She was named in honor of Fred Flintstone's wife, right? And her name Wilma, isn't that correct? She's a beautiful person, as you can see. I think she needs a Neiman Marcus makeover of some sort. If she'd comb her hair, would it be possible to make a person like of that kind of, this is a reconstruction, remember. This is someone, an anthropologist who took a skeleton, took the skull, and reconstructed what the face would look like. And we'll see the details of that in a minute. But that, for some reason, they want to make these people look as wild and ugly as possible. I don't know if that's a point about modern humans, that they don't want anybody else to resemble them very closely. But could you take a person like that and tidy them up and rework their face and make them look? Well, apparently you could, and I'll tell you why. What? Yes. Yeah. Because when Cain was marked, it was a genetic mark, and all of his descendants looked like him. Now, right away, Cain married a descendant of Adam, didn't he? He had to take a wife from somewhere. It was either a sister or a niece, and she looked like the descendants of the sons of God. But so they hybridized immediately, you see. So the hybrid had some characteristics of both. And later on, the sons of God married the daughters of men. And so we'll see there was quite a bit of cross, I hate to say crossbreeding, but that's what it amounts to in a technical sense. Now, if you turn her sideways, you can see the distinctions that God made between these two races. It's only a few genes. Out of 20,000 genes that we know about in the human genome, which was pretty definitively determined 10 years ago, only about 75 have any changes between the two. She has, that's a modern human female in the back and the same Wilma in the front. She has a pronounced brow and larger, let's see if I can get the thing to work here, larger cheekbones, you can see, and practically no chin. See the difference in their chins. There are a few other differences. Her eyes are actually more recessed in her skull. And she has a bigger brain than modern man. perhaps because the front is protruding, of the skull is protruding a little more. But so there are these differences that make her quite distinctive. And anybody that came across Cain would know that he had been marked, that he was different from everybody else in the world. And then later on, as his descendants grew in number, of course, there were these two competing races on this one continent. Whether they divided the land and they had two different states, or how they split that up, the warlike tribe is likely to predominate. Likely, would you think? They don't follow the rules. And they overrun. And probably gave the sons of God a lot of difficulty, such that they were calling upon God for protection again and again. And would God protect their race? Of course he would. Just as he would protect his children in today's world. So, when men began to increase in number on the earth and daughters were born to them, the sons of God saw that the daughters of men were beautiful. Wilma wasn't a very good example of that, was she? But the sons of God liked these daughters, and they married any of them they chose. Then the Lord said, "My spirit will not contend with man forever, for he's mortal. His days will be 120 years. And ultimately that goal was reached many centuries later. But the lifespan of man began to drop after the flood pretty precipitously. And in verse 4, the Nephilim were on the earth in those days and also afterwards. Now, afterwards doesn't mean necessarily after the flood. It must mean after the time when this interbreeding began to happen. When the sons of God went into the daughters of men and had children by them, apparently in the two races that had been kept separate as they crossbred, then there's something called hybridization leads to much larger individuals than, there's a term for that. I can't think of it at the moment. But anyway, it's a biological thing that if two races are kept apart and then put back together, there's a vigor in the hybridization of the two that you don't see in either one. But anyway, there were giants. Nephilim means giants. They were the heroes of old, men of renown. So did the sons of God and the daughters of men, did these two races interbreed? And the answer is yes. And that's what this story tells us, that modern sciences, they thought for the longest time that they were separate and that they were different races and that they couldn't interbreed. But now the evidence is there. They did. And that's what the Bible says happened. That's why I think that these two groups of people in the ancient world fit very well into the story of Genesis. You got to put them somewhere, I think, don't you? And there seems to be, that explanation seems to be an obvious one. Now we'll see some clues in Revelation about that. The Lord saw how great man's wickedness on the earth had become. So the earth was a tumultuous, terrible place to live in the time of Noah. Apparently, wickedness, every inclination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil all the time. We worry about our time living in a bad time, but it's not like that, okay? It could be a whole lot worse than the world we live in now. The Lord was grieved that he had made man on the earth, and his heart was filled with pain. So the Lord said, "I will wipe mankind whom I have created from the face of the earth, men and animals and creatures that move along the ground, birds of the air, for I am grieved that I have made them." But Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. He was in this descent of the righteous sons of God. Now the earth was corrupt in God's sight and was full of violence. I want to emphasize that aspect of it, that there was a considerable strain on the sons of God. God saw how corrupt the earth had become, for all the people on earth had corrupted their ways. How many of the people on earth? All of them. That's a pretty terrible situation in which the righteous found themselves. Now here's something about the antediluvian population. You've seen this before. We talked about it in the study of the flood. If you start with two people, Adam and Eve, and they have 20 children and make 10 families, that's 22 people total. Those 10 families have 20 children, that's 200, and in 100 families, and that makes a total of 222. And remember, nobody's dying in the early generations. They're just accumulating because they live hundreds of years. And so the 10th generation comes along around 1,000 years after the release of Adam and Eve from the Garden of Eden. And if this trend holds, you got 2 billion people on the earth. That's almost as many as we have now. Now, some of them drifted off into sin, as we've seen. Cain's descendants may not have lived as long because they ran a much more dangerous path, killing each other, and so there may not be that many, but we still have a very heavily populated earth. And that's the story of the third and the fourth seals. When the Lamb opened the third seal, I heard the third living creature say, "Come." I looked, and there before me was a black horse. So he had a white horse, a red horse, and a black horse. Its rider was holding a pair of scales in his hand. We have a symbol in our world of a woman with a pair of scales. What does that mean? Justice and judgment, doesn't it? Then I heard what sounded like a voice among the four living creatures. So, see, they're throwing their voice here. They're making the voice fit to the scene that John is looking at. And he said, "A quart of wheat for a day's wages and 3 quarts of barley for a day's wages, and do not damage the oil and the wine." That last phrase there, I think, is something of an irony, a joke. The poor people aren't drinking wine, or they don't have oil. But work all day, and you get a quart of wheat that you can grind out on a hand mill and make into a small piece of bread to share with your whole family. I mean, how are you going to get by on that? Well, instead of using wheat, you go to barley. Barley is a poorer grain used by the poor, and you get 3 quarts of barley for a day's wages. Work all day, and you get just barely enough food to feed your family a little bit. And it's starvation wages, starvation diet. When Lamech had lived 182 years, this is Noah's father, he had a son. He named him Noah and said, "He will comfort us in the labor and painful toil of our hands caused by the ground the Lord has cursed." Why did Noah say that? Well, in this scenario, one possibility that occurred to me, and I don't know if it's right or not, was that the men, the Neanderthal men, the Neanderthal race had dominated the sons of God, but they couldn't kill them because they were the source of all of their agriculture. They needed some dietary material from plants and fruits and vegetables and wheat and barley, as they've talked about before, and they couldn't raise it because of the curse that God had placed upon Cain and his descendants. And so they had put the sons of God into servitude to do the farming for them, you see. And so Noah's father was very concerned about the situation they were in, and the ground could yield for them, but it was very difficult, but didn't yield at all for Cain's descendants. Now the Lamb opened the fourth seal. I heard the voice of the fourth living creature say, "Come." I looked, and there before me was a pale horse. The word pale there is chloros. It really, I think, ought to read green. That's what the Greek word means. But we don't see any green horses, and so they decided the translators would just call it a pale horse. Its writer was named Death, Thanatos, and Hades was following close behind. So what's going to overtake the world? Death is going to claim a large part of the people of the world. Hades following close behind him, what is Hades? That's where the dead go, isn't it? That's the realm of the dead souls before judgment. And so they were given power over a fourth of the earth. Who gave them that power? To kill? Satan. Who's in charge of death up until Christ? Satan owns death, doesn't he? And so it's only now that we see a large cohort of these people dying. They were given power over a fourth of the earth to kill by sword, famine, and plague. The word plague is again death. I think it's death following famine. Starvation is the way that probably ought to read. And by the wild beasts of the earth. So there's another feature here. Wild beasts are killing people, you see. So there's another element to this story. The wild beasts of the earth are killing these people, and a fourth of the people die. Now, there's still a lot of people. Even take out a fourth out of a billion people, and you still got 750,000. That's still a lot of people. When he opened the fifth seal, I saw under the altar the souls of those who had been slain because of the word of God and the testimony they had maintained. Why had they been killed? Well, their testimony about what? God's word. This is what God said. And they killed them for saying that. We could face that someday in our world too. But that's what they faced. They called out in a loud voice, "How long, sovereign Lord, holy and true, until you judge the inhabitants of the earth and avenge our blood?" Then each of them was given a white robe. They were told to wait a little longer until the number of their fellow servants and brothers who were to be killed as they had been was completed. There's a number that God is looking for here. That's kind of interesting. And the phrase, "avenge our blood." See, vengeance had not been exercised in that first world. And so they were looking for vengeance. Each of them was given a white robe. What does that represent? Go back to the letters to the churches, and one of them was told that the ones who overcome will be given a white robe. And the white robe represents righteousness, and it was given to them, as we've been talking about in Romans. It isn't earned. But we will see later on, these people come up again later on in Revelation, and we'll see a little bit more about what they did that pleased God. And so they're looking for vengeance. God has not allowed vengeance, but God will avenge in their behalf. And so they were the righteous because they were given a white robe. And they're told to wait a little longer. There's a time coming, God said, when we'll do everything that you want us to do. Once the number of their fellow servants and brothers who were to be killed. And that suggests to me that probably almost all of the righteous were killed. They didn't die a natural death. That's not spelled out for us. It's a conjecture. But it could be that that's the case. And God is looking for a total number. That number that we'll find out next week is 144,000. Do you suppose God's looking for a number of righteous now? Burton Kaufman thought so, and I always thought that was kind of an interesting statement he made. God has a number in mind, and when that last individual is saved, and maybe when he dies, then God will end the world. when the last individual died in this situation, the last righteous to die, his name was Methuselah. Isn't that an interesting name? And the name means he dies and it is sent. I think he was the last. He died the year of the flood, and he was the grandfather of Noah. And his name was given to him by Enoch, who was a prophet. God may have asked Enoch to name his son that. And then when he died, the flood came and washed them all away. He dies, and it is sent. How would you like that for a name? The names mean something, of course, and you could use a name like Ruth or Mary or Joseph or Harold, and those names mean something too, don't they? Did you ever look up the meaning of your name? I have a name that I haven't been able to find in any register, but the common names are there. So, that's the end point of tonight's story, but it's a very interesting one, trying to put together a coherent picture of the world before the flood. And you see, that fits right here in our story, taking the time, the thread of history from creation down through the patriarchs to the time of the flood. And next week, there's the flood. And as you read, the next set of readings is a little longer. It's about two chapters long. As you read there, you won't see the word flood anywhere, but you'll see several hints that tell you that's what he's talking about. Particularly when you see that at the time this catastrophe overtakes them, they all race into the mountains, to the caves. You wonder, what in the world is happening that drives them to the mountains and drives them into the caves? And the answer is, of course, the flood, and the fact that all of the wild animals who had been killing people too are trying to take refuge there at the same time. So that's one interesting clue, and you'll see some more that we'll talk about next week. Now, on the back side of your handout is this little story that was in the Houston Chronicle just a couple of weeks ago, that says analysis of the tartar in the teeth of the Neanderthals. Isn't that an interesting thing to be studying? Contains fossil records of the fact that they ate vegetables, ate grains and vegetables, and not just meat, but somebody was giving them vegetables, and of course that had to be those who could raise them. And so all of the stories that are coming out about the Neanderthals fit this scenario in the ancient world that we have in the Bible if we put the two things together. Now, some of you have some puzzled looks on your faces. We've got a couple of minutes if you have a question or two. No? You're stunned into silence. Okay. Corey's going to read the announcements and lead us in a prayer.